Ships are going all the way round Africa to avoid the Houthi net. If Israel wants trading partners, now they might be just a little harder to get. We can blockade ports all over, north, south, east, and west. But the Houthi army are the ones who are no doubt blocking the traffic the best. Shukran Jazilan to the Houthi army, standing for the conscience of us all. When they say no business as usual, while the bombs continue to fall.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favourite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, none were surprised. Vladimir Putin won an overwhelming mandate to continue in the office of the president in Russia over the weekend. But to hear the Anglo-American media reports, that entirely predictable event is merely a claim made by the Kremlin. Just how are we in the West to go on in the world with our faculties clouded with such nonsense? And every day it gets worse with ever more draconian message management measures being devised to reach right into social media. John Helmer is an antidote to the poisoned press on Russia, especially. John's a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from there and persists as the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. John has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and has served as advisor to government at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and his lately released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. His latest article at Dances with Bears, When It Comes to Fighting Russian Diamonds, The Jewish Diamond Trade and De Beers Are a Busted Flush, looks at the cascading negative effects for Israel of its barbarous Gaza campaign. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you know, it's always my pleasure. Now, John, before getting to your latest article at Dances with Bears, can we confirm here once and for all, because there is some confusion this side of the Atlantic, did Vladimir Putin win the election Sunday?
Yes, he did. Not only that, but there are a couple of unusual things about it. The turnout was very high. 73% when I last checked, a bit over 73%. Turnout's very high. That's unusually high, which means that Russian voters were keen to express their opinion. The second thing is that it's a record high vote for Putin himself, 87%. And let's be clear about it. With high turnout and a high vote for the president, what does that mean? It means that there is an overwhelming popular Russian mandate for Putin to finish the Ukraine, end of the war by winning it. This is a very important and rather obvious point, but with all the welter of nonsense written by in the Western media, that there were faults in the election system and so forth, this is ignoring that there's a huge popular mandate to win the war with a maximum effort now. So that President Putin's position has been to keep his foot on the brake until the election result. The election result is in, and it's a clear mandate for a Russian offensive to take Novorossiya. We'll come to what that means in a minute. The second thing that's worth pointing out is how badly the Communist Party did. The Communist Party scored just over 4%, or 4.5%, 4.7%. The numbers aren't quite finished yet, but that means that the largest opposition party, the best organized opposition party, the traditional Communist Party of Russia, failed dismally. It is not offering any alternative to the president on the domestic issues.
Yeah, I thought that the communists were like 18-20% or something like that across the country in their support base.
That's the traditional amount, yes. Around 20%, usually undercounted by vote fraud and other manipulation. But yes, it ought to have been like that. So long as Gennady Zyuganov, the head of the Communist Party since the end of the Soviet Union, is in charge, it's essentially a dead man walking, and it offers no credible opposition on domestic policy. That's
At least the now I'm looking at a CNN headline here, and I don't want to confuse people. I don't really watch much CNN, but it popped up, and it says Putin extends one-man rule in Russia after stage-managed election devoid of credible opposition. Now, you've legitimated that headline, John, in at least one aspect, in there not being any credible opposition to Putin. But that headline, to me, sort of sums up the entirety of the Western media reaction or analysis,
well,
if you can call it
yeah,
that.
I mean, your breath is precious. My breath is precious. We don't waste air on CNN.
Yeah, I know. But it's important because this is what people are over here are exposed to. And a lot of people form their opinions on dribble like this from CNN and the rest.
Let's put it this way. They misunderstand what credible opposition means. Russia is in a major war, an existential defense of its security. And there's no opposition to that. No opposition to that. Therefore, Putin represented a credible mandate of the overwhelming majority of Russian people.
Well,
so
John,
in
when you say
time, what he's doing is that. Second, and go on.
Oh, no, sir, I don't want to interrupt you, but I do want to get a point in, too, that you did mention that, okay, now the election's over, he can take his foot off the brake. There's been criticism that even over this last two and some years that Russia hasn't really been fighting to win. They've been fighting to just sort of hold a kind of stasis. Do you put any credibility into that claim? And can you elucidate on how his foot has been on the brake and how it might come off and why?
Well, that's a big question, and we can spend a lot of time on that. Throughout the conduct of the special military operation, so from February 2022 till now, there's been a free press in Russia in the form of the military bloggers, the war correspondents at the front, and some major figures, Boris Rajim, Mikhail Zvinchuk, Alexander Kotz, and others, who've been accumulating news from the front and providing military analysis. There are several others, and that group, I'm calling them the mill bloggers, are the people who provide all the material, which are cut and pasted by U.S. people selling subscriptions to their variously named websites, but add nothing except their understanding from a U.S. point of view of what the Russian military bloggers know much better. So the front line of reporting of the war has carried all sorts of criticism of tactical performance, operational performance, and strategic goals. At the tactical level, everybody remembers an operational level, Yevgeny Prigozhin had to say during the Battle of Bakhmut. There have been all sorts of criticisms since then of operational quality, supply of ammunition, equipment of forces, and so on. Where we are now is that until the election, it's clear President Putin wanted to minimize any Russian operations that would either take significant casualties and risk potentially embarrassing military defeats. At the same time, we know that the Ukrainian forces have been attempting to escalate their pinprick operations on the Black Sea to sink some small ships with swarms of drones and make it appear that the Black Sea has been lost to the Russian Navy. That's not true, but there have been mistakes made, clearly criticized in the Russian press, which have resulted in the removal of the head of the Russian Navy, his replacement, and a reconstruction of the command of the Black Sea Fleet to correct the mistakes and improve the defenses and increase the operational capacities of the Navy in that sector. At the same time, the battles of Bakhmut, followed by the Battle of Avdiivka, have been fought slowly, surely, and with great loss of life on the Ukrainian side and great destruction of territory. At the same time, the Ukrainians have been building massive fortifications along the northern border around Chernihiv region, and they're now doing the same around Odessa. And so what you have is a situation in which essentially the Russian side has been tolerating or allowing or conceding the massive building of fortifications by the Ukrainians to cover what they expect will be a northern offensive, north from Belarus and northern Russia, the northern regions like Belgorod, towards Kiev, in the center from the central sector of the current line of contact towards Dnipropetrovsk, across the river towards Kiev, and in the southern area or sector around Nikolaev and Odessa and the coastline. The fortifications also are manned by heavy NATO-supplied equipment and fresh Ukrainian forces. So the question, the huge question strategically, is why did the President Putin allow this building, this massive construction of defense fortifications? And since they now exist, what will be the Russian move to deal with them? And what remains of the Russian commitment to incorporate Russian cities like Odessa and Kharkov and incorporate all of the eight regions, not simply the four regions of Nova Russia, and then onwards, what's to become of Kiev and what's to be what President Putin, after the election, on election night at party headquarters, called the creation of a sanitary zone. Am I talking too much? Is that too much detail to absorb? Does it answer your question? Do we want
it may be too much to absorb. It's all news to most people here. I'm following you along, but I don't understand the question that you posed. There's two things, really. As you say, why allow this construction of these fortified defensive positions when, if they have to be taken later, that is a very uphill struggle that's going to cost a lot of Russian lives. And when you say that there's fresh Ukrainian forces, from a lot of the reports that I've been reading and hearing, there isn't a huge supply of fresh Ukrainian forces. So where are these new recruits coming from? Are they like these 40 and older men we're seeing press ganged from the streets of Kyiv, or is there some other source of soldiery available?
Good questions, and let's try and unpack them as best I can. As my sources tell me, not cut and pasted like you can read on the US side, what's happening is this. The Ukrainian regime, Mr. Zelensky's regime in Kiev, is pressing these large numbers of individuals who are simply thrown into indefensible positions along the line of contact in the war that's followed Bakhmut and then Avdiivka. They are expendables. It's a terrible thing to say, but that's what he's doing. They're running out of expendables. The question you raised is, what remains behind the fortifications or in the fortifications along the northern front? That's Chernigov protecting Kiev from the north, and around Dnipropetrovsk in the center, protecting Kiev from the center and the river, and Dnieper River. And then what are the forces and fortifications around Odessa protecting the coast? Those, there's an argument, better to say, a difference of assessment among the Russians who know and who aren't going to talk publicly about what they know, and nor am I. Let's just say I don't know, but if I did from the sources, I wouldn't be saying. What I can say is that there is a reasonable difference of assessment of how strong the manpower manning those fortifications are for the expected future Russian drive on what remains of the Ukraine. So there are two, there are several different military intelligence assessments of two different types of forces. Let's call it the cannon fodder that's being picked up in the street, dragooned and press ganged, as you've said. Many people have seen the videos of how this is done. And they're thrown at the line of contact in the east. But they're not being sent to the fortifications in the north, center, and south. They're different. Now, President Putin has said, the general staff have said, the mainstream Russian media have been saying, we won't move on an offensive until the strategic reserves of the Ukraine are exhausted. What's a strategic reserve? Well, let's not get into military technicalities. It's the difference between the cannon fodder in the east. And yesterday, according to the Russian Defense Ministry bulletin, more than 1,650 men were killed in the operations along the line. 1,650, that's probably the highest casualty number I've seen in the conflict so far. Most of it concentrated in the regions from which Belgorod was attacked over the weekend. Still, the nature of those forces is different from the nature of the forces believed to be in reserve to protect Odessa, Kharkov, Dnipropetrovsk, Chernigov, and so on. To a certain extent, we know from the way Bakhmut, Mariupol, Avdiivka have been fought, that let's call it the best of the Ukrainian forces are in fortified locations in residential areas of these main cities, lying behind these elaborate concrete multiple layer fortifications facing the direction that the Russian forces are expected to come. So what you have is a second line of defense in front of the city, and inside the city you have your most experienced forces dug in under residential buildings, so that were there to be an assault on a city like Kharkov or Odessa, the entire city will be destroyed as Bakhmut and Avdiivka were. That's why the Russians don't have any intention, militarily or politically or strategically speaking, of trying frontal assaults on those cities. Those cities will be bypassed. So there are two kinds of forces, as I've just said. There are two kinds of front and reserve forces located differently according to the way the Ukraine and the NATO commanders and the politicians think the Russian offensive will focus on. And we can get into the question then of what is to be decided now that Putin declares after Election Day, we're going to have a sanitary zone in what remains of the territory subordinated to Kiev. That's the language he used. He's not saying what's going to be done to incorporate Novorossiya, the full eight regions, which include Odessa and Kharkov. What Putin is saying is what is left of the Ukraine will be a sanitary zone. And we can get into the discussion of what sanitary means when you apply it to people like Zelensky.
Okay, let's do that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John is an antidote to the poisoned press that we here on this side of the Atlantic are constantly exposed to, especially when it comes to all things Russian. He's a journalist and author. He's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia and persists as the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. He's too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Some of his many book titles include Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, and his recently released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. We're speaking today around his article, which we haven't got to yet, When It Comes to Fighting Russian Diamonds, The Jewish Diamond Trade and De Beers Are a Busted Flush. Well, when you say, John, when you talk about a sanitary zone, is this like a... Like we, and we've talked about this in the past, the plan from the Russian side to create a kind of DMZ a la the Korean, the North and South Korea buffer zone. Is this what you're talking about?
Yes and no, Chris. There can't be in the Ukraine a DMZ like there is in between the North and South Korea. You can't. That's a no man's land, and it's relatively... shallow. I've forgotten exactly how many kilometers lie between the North Korean front and the South Korean front, but it's shallow and it's empty. What it's a fair question. What does President Putin mean by a sanitary zone? And you can bet your life he and the general staff will not be discussing openly what this means. What it's meant to signal now that he said it is my foot is now off the brake and I will leave to my general staff, particularly General Gerasimov, the decisions on what will be done when appropriate. Putin used the word when and where appropriate. So let me try and define the parameters. We don't know where it will come. We know what we can't see. There is no massing of Russian forces for a significant ground offensive in any direction, as there was prior to the special military operation in February 2022. We can't say where or how it will come. We can say that the parameters of the Russian offensive to implement the notion, the two objectives, the incorporation of Novorossiya and the creation of a sanitary zone which cannot threaten the Russian territories. That has to be extended, and this has been said many times. It was said by Mr. Pushilin the other day from Donetsk. The sanitary zone has to be as deep as the range of NATO-supplied weapons that could strike. That doesn't just mean HIMARS and other rockets and artillery pieces, which have ranges of, let's say, between 40 and 100 kilometers. It means ranges of significant missile attacks and drone attacks. Drone attacks, we now can see the Ukrainian capacity to develop long-range and fire long-range drones with small explosive warheads. The range can be anywhere beyond 500 to 700 or 800 kilometers. So to push that kind of weaponry back into the western side of a sanitary zone raises a question: is there anything left of the Ukraine after you formed the new Russia on the east side of the Dnieper River and formed a demilitarized or sanitary zone, always the objective of the special military operation, which will include Kyiv. It's not a no man's land. It can't be the Korean DMZ because Kyiv will be in the middle of it. Well, how far west then will the sanitary zone extend? Will the territory of region, historical region of Galicia, the region from which Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada.
That's her next job.
From, and in which the commanders of the Canadian military come from. This region, the capital's Lvov, was occupied by the German army and made part of an administration of southern Poland and western Ukraine during the World War. It's subject to Polish claim. It's subject to Hungarian claim. What would be left? Will that be a sanitary zone from which there can be no attack on Russian territory? Well, that remains to be seen. Let me just quickly say, Chris, do we have the time or are we out of time?
Well, we're very close. Yeah, if you can do it in a minute and so or so.
Right. I think the parameters of what's going to come will be there will be no major city battles. There will be a program of depopulation to drive Ukrainians out of Western Ukraine into Poland. There will be a resumption of the electricity war to deprive the cities of the capacity and the military of the capacity to fight. And there will be a focus on restoring the Russian cities of Kharkov, Odessa, and others along the river.
Yeah, well, all of that sounds I'm not even going to weigh in on that right now. There's so much more to say, and we don't have time to say it in this segment. For you listening at Simon Fraser, thanks for tuning in. If you want to hear more, go to guerrilla-radio.com, where John and I are going to continue this conversation. Thanks to Ken Stone for coming on from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Check them out and their work on both on Gaza and promoting Eve Engler and Dimitri Lascaris's separate tours. For Eve, the book tour. For Dimitri, another talking tour about his recent fact-finding mission through the Middle East. I'll say thanks to you, John, but we will pick it up again after the break in the longer version.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Ships are going all the way around Africa to avoid the Houthi net. If Israel wants trading partners, now they might be just a little harder to get. We can blockade ports all over, north, south, east, and west. But the Houthi army are the ones who are no doubt blocking the traffic the best. Shukran Jazilan to the Houthi army, standing for the conscience of us all. When they say no business as usual, while the bombs continue to fall.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York, Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name of.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Speak up. 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 Speak up.